Welcome back to the Commerce Collective, a podcast brought to you by Flywheel. You're listening to This Month Above the Fold, a monthly series on the Commerce Collective feed where Patrick Miller, co-founder of Flywheel, covers the most important e-commerce stories each month. And this is your June 2024 special edition. I'm Emma Irwin, brand marketing manager at Flywheel and host of this podcast. Let's get right into it. Patrick, how has your month been? How has the cycling been going?
Did a mountain bike race over the weekend. The first half was fun. The second half, things fell apart, but you know, it was fun. But my wife and I did a 6-hour race together and we won. So 3 years running of winning that. So that was fun. And it's hot.
Yeah, very hot.
How about you? What'd you do?
I actually have been in Europe all of June. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah, I'm back in New York now just as like a filibuster until I go back to Arkansas. But it was very nice. It was a very long time to live out of a suitcase, but we did it. We made it to London to work with the team in Cannes and then did my own travels. So it was very fun.
Awesome. Yes. That's a very fun one.
Yes. Okay. This month, we're doing something a little bit, just a tiny bit different. We're going to cover Flywheel's recent paper that you authored titled The Big Shift, because in my opinion, it was a big thing for Flywheel to actually publish a paper out into the world. And it's a really cool paper that happened to come out in the month of June. So I'd love to start with your kind of inspiration for writing the paper / a overview for anyone who might not be familiar with it.
Sure. And co-authored. So Katie Box co-authored it with me. Katie, longstanding colleague and really driving force behind it. And we sort of just wanted to, you know, take a step back and look at the industry in a little bit more of a macro focus. And also, like, personally, like, I'm kind of sick of PowerPoint. And so, like, I've been singing and dancing around PowerPoint slides for a long time. And it was just fun to write, quite frankly, and just to, you know, and to look at the industry in a way of like, okay, well, what's changing? Why is it? And how do we think about the relationship and the tensions and the value created between brands and retailers? And so sort of at the core of that is sort of like thinking on sort of different axes of like, you know, historically, you know, brands tend to be national or global. Retailers, because of the physicality of the store, tend to be, you know, local or regional. There are very few, you know, international, you know, retailers. And so because of that, if I go back, 100 years, you know, retail's totally fractured. A&P Corporation comes around. It starts to then create additional horizontal nature just because they had so many different stores. Then you then look at like Sears, Kmart, and then Walmart. They are able to then nationalize, the biggest being Walmart, 4,800 stores across the country. And so the balance of power shifted from the brands who were historically nationally to the retailers because they all of a sudden became national as well. And so we wanted to look at this and say, okay, well, does e-commerce change that? And are things shifting? And, you know, and if so, how and why? And then we then looked at it from the sense of like, okay, one, selection, and then two, sort of, you know, data and insights and how they are shared, you know, how they are determined, and then who, you know, who can gain an advantage and not just gain an advantage against, you know, one another, but create value together. And ultimately that's what we're trying to figure out is the Venn diagram between brands and retailers where they both were able to create value.
Something that I've been thinking about on your point of selection and then data and insights is that retailers, we know that they want this endless selection because that increases the search competition. Advertisers have to then move up the funnel. They want more data, blah, blah, blah. But I'm kind of curious, do you see a future where retailers like don't want endless selection anymore? I'm very stuck on this idea of like the homogenization of all the marketplaces and all of them just kind of seeming the same. And Amazon even recently had that like changing in that seller central policy where they're like, we want all manufacturers to just list basically all items on marketplace, which is different from the historical 1P versus 3P. But like, tell me more about endless or selection in general.
Let's take a step back. When I think about selection, it's not just, you know, selection on an endless aisle. There really actually aren't that many, you know, marketplaces, but there are a whole lot of retailers. And within retailers, most of them are constrained by the physicality of the store. So if I'm convenience, I've got 3,000 SKUs, regional grocery, 30,000, supercenter, you know, 100 and some thousand. And so they may have an e-commerce business because, you know, there's a cell phone involved. But if I'm picking out of store, I'm losing out on the biggest growth driver, which is incremental selection. So if I'm picking out of a regional grocery store, there's only, you know, so many slots for peanut butter. And so if I'm selling on, you know, if I'm a brand and I'm driving that, you know, sort of channel shift, well, it's profit decretive because somebody's got to pick the thing, because it used to be I pick the thing. Now the Instacart shopper picks the thing and then delivers it to my door. It used to be my guest. It's no longer my guest. It's now the Instacart shopper. So who pays for that? And what do I get in upside? And so, yeah, shareholders like love the idea of, hey, the e-commerce business is growing, but if I don't have the incremental selection, I can't bridge to profit. And so, or it's bridging to profit's more challenging. And so think of it, you know, so then if I then compare it to pure marketplaces, well, I can list anything. And so I can then make a bigger widget and I can then create enough penny profit to care, you know, to bridge for outbound freight because the ASP gets to be high enough because it's sort of a unit economics game, not a basket game, or at least an asynchronous basket game. And so I can then create it, sort of make whatever thing I want. But the retailer will oftentimes say, well, I want all the things because they can have all the things. And if I'm a brand, well, maybe I don't want them to have all the things. And maybe I want to have a, you know, sort of a channel strategy that creates differentiation, you know, by retailer or across my D2C. And so whereas like in traditional brick and mortar retail, you know, the game is selling into the retailer and like, how do I get, you know, my face out? How do I pay slotting to get the eye level? Well, on a marketplace, it's the opposite. And they want all the things, but you, the brand, don't have to give them all the things. And so how do you create thoughtful selection across different retailers, across different classes of trade to best optimize, you know, both profit share and growth across all of the various retailers and marketplaces? Now, on the other side of that is then sort of the, you know, sort of on the data and insight side. And so you're like, well, why do they care about that? Well, they care about that because, you know, to quote, you know, Doug McMillon from a couple of years ago talking about their ads business, you know, he's never seen something with such high gross margins, you know, in Walmart. And yeah, like ads business is really high margin. It's great. And, you know, and it's growing. But if I'm a brand, well, why am I going to invest? You know, what, you know, at this point, what the hell is the difference between all these RMNs? Like if I have one more person come up to me telling me that like I can buy on their DSP, so what? Like it's, you know, especially when you start getting to where brands have lots of distribution. And so, you know, there has to be a reason for me to give them a nickel. And so if I'm going to give them a nickel, what are the insights they can give me? And oh, by the way, if I'm a consumer brand, I've never had closed loop before. And this is the thing that I don't want people get. The closed loop is such a big deal. Yes, the ultimate outcome is sales, but it's really just the ability to see of, you know, sort of how a customer is interacting throughout versus if I'm like, if I go back like 5 years ago and people were buying on a DSP and I'm a consumer brand without a DSP or without a D2C, what are the metrics I look at? Like clicks? So what? Nobody clicks on ads. Like, you know, or it's a fat thumb half the time. You know, is it view through? Like, maybe there's 20 other ads at the same time. And so there's no way to actually see efficacy without a closed loop. And so now that retailers have this, they can then expose that to the brands. Brands can then sort of optimize across and then it can create a whole lot more value by leveraging these different retail media networks.
Got it. And on that, I'm thinking about how when we work with our clients who are the advertisers, and it's like kind of pulling teeth to get this data out of the retailers. But at the same time, I think there's a point in the paper for like retailers to differentiate themselves. They have to then be willing to provide more and more data so that there is this closed loop. But what if someday like every single retailer just provides all of the data? Is that a good thing? Like how do they then differentiate themselves further?
So I think like I would bifurcate between what's on-site, what's off-site. And so what's on-site, you know how you prove efficacy? Did more trucks show up? Like at the end of the day, like I put a nickel into the machine, did a quarter pop out or a dime pop out? And so, and over what, you know, period of time. And then on the sort of more like call it brand building side, personally, like I see a future where you're just going to have a couple of huge marketplaces and that they are then sort of the new walled gardens because they're going to have, at least for consumer brands, because they're going to have the closed loop. And so as evidenced by, you know, Walmart goes out and buys Vizio, Amazon opens up Prime Video as well as APC, you know, to sort of both get additional publishers as well as ability to deliver video. And so if it becomes those two, you know, sort of at least in my very American perspective, if they become the two dominant players or continue to be the two dominant players, it will then be a game of all the pubs stack on top. Why would all the publishers work with them? Well, because brands would be willing to pay more if they have higher yield and you can see a closed loop. And oh, by the way, all the publishers used to be just chasing, you know, monthly active users. Now all of a sudden they care about EBITDA. So they have to increase their yield, and which then, you know, sort of how do they do that? Well, partner with a retailer that can then close the loop. So you then have sort of like those two of the dominant ones, you know, sort of publishers. I think, you know, I mean, we're certainly seeing in the marketplace, like they're going to, you know, there's going to be merging there. Everybody's got streaming fatigue. As they do that, they're looking for additional revenue. So they'll then partner with Vizio. They'll then partner with Amazon. And then that then creates a new avenue for brands to go after, you know, sort of using the closed loop in upper funnel to prove how upper funnel then translates into, you know, cases shipped. And doing it deterministically. I mean, it's going to be a combination of determinism and probabilism, but you know, that's sort of the other thing I'm trying to work on.
I'd love to move into another theme in the paper, which I'm sure nobody is surprised that this made it in here, but this entrance of the Chinese marketplaces like Temu into the Western market. And so not only do we have the different Western retailers competing with each other, but they also have this force, this newer force to work against as well. And so I'm thinking about how like Temu and Shein, for example, they're in categories that, or they focus on categories that are slightly different from Amazon and Walmart. But at the same time, we just saw, and this is a nice little insert of e-com news into this episode, Amazon's going to make its own little clone of a discount store. And so can you tell me about this? Like what's going on here with Amazon and how this all ties together?
You know, you remember sort of like the famous Bezos quotation of, you know, what will continue to be true 20 years from now or whatever. And, you know, fast shipping is one of them. Yeah, for cough syrup and condoms, yeah, you need it right away. But for a Temu t-shirt, like, I don't care. I can wait a week. And not only that, like Amazon has even shown that, like, you know, they're consolidating boxes and they're saying, hey, have it all delivered in one box. You know, do it on Prime Day, or it'll even give you like little nudges in there. Cause like, you know, it's just too much cardboard. And so, and you don't need it, you know, you don't need a fidget spinner right away. So, you know, Temu has said, yes, that, and they are saying like, okay, takes a week to get it. And, you know, we have a called a loophole called, you know, whatever, but the de minimis provision, you know, within sort of when you think about tariffs. And so that then saves them, you know, 22 points, you know, sort of right off the bat. And if you compare that to like Amazon's advantage, you know, 10, 15 years ago with sales tax, it's like 4 to 5 times the advantage. So people can then go out and then it can get the stuff and it's really inexpensive and it takes a little while, but who cares? Cause like, it's just another dinosaur t-shirt for my toddler and I don't care if it takes a week. So they've been able to sort of take a lot of share, both Temu as well as Shein. And Shein's actually getting ready to, is preparing to list on the London Stock Exchange. So we'll actually get a view as far as like, you know, how big the thing really is. I think it's likely going to be the largest apparel retailer in the world, you know, once they list the numbers, but you know, we'll see. So anyway, so they're taking advantage of the idea that they're sending onesie twosies into the States. They don't have to pay a tariff as opposed to Amazon, where you put it on a pallet and then you pay, you know, 22 or 23 points, whatever it is. And so Amazon's now saying, oh, I don't know, like we're going to then create the same thing and then, you know, ship them in, you know, onesie twosies from overseas. The other one I think is actually interesting with this is like getting back to the idea of selection. It's like, how much is too much selection? And one of the things we've seen recently is like, you know, Amazon created like this auto variation rule like a few years ago. And so like my favorite one is like you search for, you know, furnace filter and it's like nothing but Filtree, you know, at least it was like 5 years ago. And so Amazon, you know, well, why? Because it's like, it's a great brand. They're share leader. You know, they've early on Amazon. And then Amazon said, hey, we're now going to collapse all these ASINs into one big variation. So you search for furnace filter and it's just one Filtree and then basically blank space. So what happens? Well, a bunch of like Chinese hacks like create a bunch of shitty selection that is just like, you know, it's poor. It's the same damn ASIN all the way across. It's just like a slightly different brand name. Well, that's an awful CX. And so, you know, so your SERP in certain ways, like there's like a, you need a almost like, there's almost too much selection. And so how do you pull it back a little bit? And so we're seeing sort of changes in how they think about variation to allow a better CX to help sort of the brands that people are looking for own a little bit more of the SERP via the variations, as opposed to just going through the auto variation, which just in certain categories incites just additional sellers that don't actually add a lot of value.
Interesting. I've never actually thought about like the purpose of the automatic variations making more space on the search results page. I'm still haunted to this day by trying to undo some of the automatic variations that would happen.
Just because you can, I mean, it doesn't mean you should. It's just an unintended consequence of it. And so I think, you know, folks are starting to figure that out. But this then gets back to the idea of selection. And so it's like, for a marketplace, your 6 foot set is a query. And so so it's sort of like, okay, well, what happens when somebody types in that query? And then, you know, where do the clicks go? Where are the conversions? And sort of what's the yield on the query?
I'm thinking about, this is like a very meta question, but I think consumers in general, especially American consumers, are quite attracted to this kind of buying things at the lowest cost sort of dynamic. And with Amazon making their own version of Temu and the Temu itself, like brand doesn't really matter. What does this mean for like the big national brands kind of as we go forward into the future of e-commerce?
Yeah, it's an existential question of what a brand is. And I would argue that like throwing your logo on something that you bought off of Alibaba is not a brand. And so it is. So when you think about brand, it's sort of like, okay, what's second moment of truth? You know, what is differentiated about it? Is it a superior product or not? And then the brand ladders off of that. And so many of these things are commodities that they're kidding themselves, you know, that they are brands. And this then goes, if you look back a few years, it's like all the Amazon aggregators that said they were buying brands. They weren't brands with a few exceptions, you know, and they were, you know, buying widgets with charming logos. And we all know how that turned out. So, you know, so it's sort of like, okay, well, what is a brand? How do I differentiate across these? And I think that's a huge one, you know, for sellers to figure out. And so it's like, if you look at the continuum of sellers, you know, going back 10 or 15 years, okay, 15 years ago, they were all arbitragers. Then they became, you know, sort of pulling in stuff from Alibaba, putting a logo in it. Now they're trying to figure out, hey, how do we verticalize? You know, how do we differentiate? And that's ultimately, I think, a very good thing. However, at the same time, you know, the Chinese factories are figuring out like, hey, they can create brands too. And so that becomes a really interesting tension point longer term. And then to your point earlier about sort of Amazon's recent changes around standards for brands, it seems like what Amazon is saying is, hey, you brand, you can list and sell, you know, as a seller. We as retail may want you as a vendor. Amazon will figure that out. And that's, you know, sort of a longstanding, you know, tension point. But what I think they're sort of also hinting at is like this idea of an exclusive retailer agreement that they don't really love. And so why would they not love that? Well, because in my mind, from seeing sort of how these folks act, it ends up being artificially high prices to the customer in the sense that the ASIN is listed by the exclusive retailer. They park it at MSRP. And then they then go after all the other sellers so that there is only that one listing. And so rather than, you know, sort of have the price bounce around because you have lots of different competition on that listing, it's parked at one price point. I think Amazon sees that as a negative CX. And so they either want that to be the brand directly selling it or they want it to be a vendor.
Got it. You should write a whole book on this. I feel like this could be an entire like textbook.
I got too many NDAs.
fair. Okay, last theme I want to cover in this episode is just this idea of the brands gaining some control back or tipping the power balance back slightly more in their favor, which is broken down in the paper as product selection and media spend and using those to your advantage. And I'm sure at this point, everyone listening is kind of like, yeah, duh, but how? Can you kind of elaborate on just what you see as the way for brands in conclusion to sort of tip some of that power back to them?
Sure. So I think on the selection front, like just because you can doesn't mean you should. And so being very thoughtful about which classes of trade and which retailers get which SKUs and how do you differentiate across them? And knowing that, you know, many of the, you know, marketplace led retailers, their goal is ubiquitous selection. And so they want what you have, i.e., you know, your SKUs. And so I remember like years and years ago, like, you know, when vendor managers were charming, they would go to like trade shows and like they'd just like walk around and, you know, and play nice with brands. And they'd always be like, hey, let me see your price list. You know, it's just like, don't do it, because they would just, you know, they would set up everything and then crap it out and whatever and have back and forth. And so, you know, sort of one, you know, being thoughtful of like, what do you list when, where, and holding some SKUs back, you know, having some just for your D2C to pull people in, like certain color variants. Apple does an excellent job of that in pulling people in, you know, to the D2C, but then also leveraging Amazon for Walmart, you know, for things like, you know, AirPods accessories, and an interesting exclusive with Walmart across one of the MacBook Airs, a lower ASP. And then on the data side, if I'm an advertiser, if I'm a brand, well, all the retailers want this thing because it's high gross margin and they've never seen high gross margin before. And this is in a lot of ways powering their share price as they build out these retail media offerings. And so in exchange for your dollars, like, what do you want? And, you know, what are the insights that you want from your customer to better understand the efficacy of your advertising and to be able to then compare it to other advertising, you know, channels? You know, there is this sort of this overarching question of like, is it trade? Is it brand? Is it shopper marketing? Yes, it is. And so, you know, sort of how do you sort of allocate those dollars across the various retailers, thinking of cost to serve, but also the different media properties? And so how do I compare Google to Meta to Amazon to Walmart to Instacart? And getting to the point where, you know, one, sort of understanding sort of the power of the advertising, you know, but also then what does that then do to retail, both on and off of those sites, to create a media mix and a sales strategy and really pulling those together to drive forward the advantage.
Very good. Very good. My last question for you is, I feel like we'd be remiss now that it's July 1st. Something big's coming up in a couple of weeks, which is Prime Day. I know you don't like predictions, but like, What are your thoughts on Prime Day? And if you can tie it back to anything in The Big Shift, go ahead.
I think it will, from a macro perspective, you know, you're seeing, you know, discretionary goods, you know, sort of slowing relative to sort of the inflation because of CPG. People are biasing towards the necessities just in a, you know, we're still in an inflationary environment. So, you know, so which then drives, you know, promo to be much more important to, you know, to move units. So as brands, you know, it's sort of like the correct strategy is yes, you advertise and you have a promotion, but like the promotion is more important than the advertising, no matter what your ad exec tells you, because people are looking for, they're looking for deals. And so, you know, the winners, especially in this sort of environment, will be the ones that then promote and then use that information to then engage with those customers long-term to turn them into, you know, a valuable, you know, customer relationship. So it's a great way to use AMC to say, hey, I picked up these folks, you know, during Prime Day. A little tidbit though, what's interesting, if you look at the CIDs over time, the ones that you acquire on Prime Day, you know, when they tend to repurchase? Turkey 5 or Turkey Infinity, whatever they're calling it now. And so, because a lot of times they end up being very price sensitive customers. And so, you know, sort of it is a watch out that you may just be fueling deal seekers as opposed to sort of sincere relationships with folks.
I'm definitely not one of those people. I've definitely never done that before. So bought a new
brand. I buy the same thing every single Prime Day. I buy a Camelback water bottle. I buy one thing. And it's, I'm always just like, how long does it take? And so you can always just see, like, I'm just like, oh, my one ace. And I'm always like, okay, is it showing up today? Is it showing up tomorrow? Is it 3 days from now? And so you can sort of see my bar napkin math is just like, all right, like how, although actually, you know, one other thing, I was complaining about delivery times on Whole Foods recently and just like how much better Instacart is. It's like now, like Amazon is, it's amazing now. And you can just like, you pull up Whole Foods Refresh and it's like time blocks all over the place. So the network is getting better and better, which is ultimately Amazon's key advantage.
Got it. Got it. I do have to, do you just lose your Camelback water bottle every year? Do you have a giant collection of them?
No, I just got a stack of them over here.
Okay.
But I do lose a lot of them. And yeah.
Yeah. Just, I figured we'd wrap up on, okay, this has to be a lot of Camelback water bottles by now.
Yeah. They're great. It's a great water bottle. I mean, it's, if you're looking for a water bottle, it is, you know, by far the best.
I believe it. All right. That can wrap us up. Love it. And that's it for this month's e-commerce news and The Big Shift. Tune into next month's episode where we'll return to our regularly scheduled programming covering e-com news exclusively. If you want to read The Big Shift white paper from Flywheel, head to the link in the description of this episode and you can find it right there. I'm Emma Irwin, and I'll see you next time.